my happiness and health was actually giving up a very kind of prestigious job. Mm-hmm. I know lots of people who have lots of money and are not very wealthy. My ultimate aim in life is about discretionary free time. That is the definition of wealth.
Dr. Paddy Barrett, cardiologist, author, and longevity expert. Trained at world-leading institutions like Scripps and Columbia, his book, Heart, An Owner's Guide and Global Newsletter are redefining how we think about health, lifespan, and soul span.
I have no interest in living longer for the sake of living longer. Music, art, literature. It's about understanding who you are and why you're here.
We're living what we think we should be doing, but what we want is here, and this piece in the middle is causing anxiety and health decline and addictions.
You have to know who you are and what you're about. I don't think that my job is to tell people what to do. My job is to help people hit their goals. If that's spending time in nature, do that. If that's spending time being the best parent, you should do that. If you want to be a Hunter S. Thompson type character who's sitting at home doing lines of cocaine, drinking chartreuse, writing the great American novel, I say you should do that.
Dr. Paddy Barrett, this is probably one of my first nervous podcasts I have, but welcome to Find Your Edge. Thank you so much for joining me today. On your Sunday, a day that you are giving up a little bit of family time, and I know that's very important to you. You have been someone I've been following on social media for quite a while, because we live in a world where there's loads of information coming at us, and I'm trying to absorb it all, and I realize that I need to refine it back and listen to a few experts, and you are definitely one of those experts. So I'm very excited for today's talk. Hopefully the questions I have for you are not going to be ones that you've heard 5,000 times, but I fear that could be the case. So if you were to give a brief description of yourself, what would that be, or how would you describe who you are and what you do?
Thanks for having me. I am a reformed interventional cardiologist, which basically means that I spent 20 years of my medical training going through specialist training in a variety of different centers around the world, and basically ended up in one of the most prestigious institutions in the entire world doing specialized invasive medical procedures on people at the very far end of their journey of heart disease, and realized right at the very end that I was in the wrong place. Insofar as that the people we were meeting in large part had heart disease in an advanced state, mm-hmm. that if you took the right steps many, many years before, you could have prevented many of those people ultimately ending there. So rather than persisting on that journey, dealing with patients with advanced coronary artery disease, I decided to go back down the mountain and reskill and retool as a preventive cardiologist. So my job was that I would never meet my past self on that table. It's not 100% possible, but that is how I found myself here, working as a preventive cardiologist and trying to get that word out.
Wow, that's a big one to go back down a mountain. I've never heard anyone use that description, but straight away the first thing that came to my head was, how was that for your ego, having to come back down that mountain that you'd climbed?
So it's a huge problem. So one of the biggest challenges when you look at people who describe what they do as an I am an X, I'm, you know, in terms of what you do, who you are and what you do become the same thing.
Yeah.
And so when what you do starts to fall apart, who you are also starts to fall apart. And your entire identity is blended into the activities that you do, and with your professional core of operating at this very elite level in world famous institutions. And you have this huge sunk cost fallacy where you've invested decades into getting to this point, and you realize you're at the wrong destination. Mm-hmm. And the truth is the sunk cost fallacy is a fallacy for all the reasons that we know of, is that it's better to say, listen, I have all this time in front of me, and how can I make better decisions now in order to end up in the place that I want to be, rather than just persisting in the place that I shouldn't be.
This whole podcast is going to go a different route than I anticipated, because you've blown my mind straight away with that description of, as I look at you on social media and what you're talking about, I didn't realize that there was that much of I've seen where you've worked, both Australia, the States, I mean, a very prestigious medical record, for want of a better phrase. Can you take us back to how your passion for medicine started? Because I feel like this could have been something that determined that turnaround on the mountain, but maybe I'm wrong.
I originally didn't want to be a doctor. I wanted to be an air sea rescue helicopter pilot. I couldn't join the Irish Air Corps because I didn't have 20/20 vision.
Oh no.
So I decided I was going to do something else. And everyone has their variety of different stories in terms of how you land at this point. There's no one in my family that's a doctor. There's no one that I really knew who was a doctor. And the slightly odd fortuitous way was that I had a dream one night that I was walking around after a doctor asking him some questions and saying, what was it like? And it sounded kind of interesting. And I woke up the next morning and I said, I think I'm going to be a doctor. And I really think that I could give you this straightforward, I like people and I like science and I like to blend the two of them together. The honest answer is I have no idea. I just realized at some subconscious level that this was something that I wanted to do. And it's turned out to be a really interesting journey.
I would imagine. So how many years ago was that?
So that would have been late 90s.
Okay. So you're 30 years in the industry, approximately, getting close to it. Amazing. And so you had a dream and that was enough to turn your whole life around and, well, I didn't turn your life, but set a trajectory that you followed.
Yeah. And people, I think one of the things that I definitely learned is people have this idea that they're supposed to know what they're supposed to do early in life. And the idea that you would ask an 18-year-old what you want to do for the rest of your life is entirely laughable. And I think you can only say with a gestalt in terms of that I want to go in this direction, and then you continue to refine your journey. As Carl Jung says, the privilege of a lifetime is becoming who you are. And it's a process, not a destination.
Of course.
And so you have to continually update that model. And I think where people run into the biggest challenges is that they, number one, they might reflect on it at the start, but they don't continue to update that model. And that's a process. And just because you can become a doctor doesn't mean that you do one specific thing. Mm-hmm. There's a whole world of options that you can do, just like every other profession. And I have often wandered down strange rabbit holes within medicine. And I would kind of broadly characterize myself as someone most likely to run away with the circus.
This episode of Find Your Edge is brought to you by Hedgehogs vs. Foxes, a video production studio crafting bold, cinematic content for brands in lifestyle, corporate, events, and more. Visit us at hvf.ie to learn more.
So would you regard yourself as a very reflective, self-reflective person in that sense that you've assessed where your journey is going a number of times, that you didn't just jump on that destination or jump on that dream and then just expect to arrive at the destination? You're obviously...
Yeah, I mean, I'm always questioning, you know, what it is that you're supposed to be doing and why. And I think that if you look at, there's really great literature in terms of palliative care staff did, that they looked at the people at the end of their life and they said, listen, what do you feel are your biggest regrets in life? And number two, which is the one that everyone guesses, is that they said that I worked too much. Number one is that you didn't have the courage to become who you are. People who kind of, you know, if you ask people deep down, they know really what it is that they are truly about, you know, what their purpose is in a general sense. It might be vague, but what they know in a directional sense, what they really should be doing. And where people suffer the most, in my view, is when they don't listen to that inner voice and when they don't have the courage to pursue it, they pay a price. And I think that's often where a lot of the stress that people find themselves experiencing in life is that they struggle with mapping their actions with their values in terms of how they live their life.
Yeah, it's very funny that as you're talking there, I love to hear someone who is an actual medical practitioner talk like that. I'm going to say something that you won't. I'm not insulting you by any means, but I view my world and your world as being very similar in a lot of ways. I'm a fitness coach. Obviously, you're in a completely different tier of how you help people. But my whole world is about, I want to prevent people getting sick. A lot of fitness coaches want to sell, you know, the six pack in 2 weeks and the, you know, whatever that is. But I got into my industry because I like working with people. I love helping people be the best version of themselves they can be. That has evolved from me thinking everyone needed to do bicep curls and running a 5K every day to now seeing the bigger picture of what health is and how dropping body fat should be a byproduct of you, you know, living a more holistic, balanced life. These are my views and things. When I look at your social media, because that's just my one avenue of how I get to witness what you do and what you talk about, your capacity to communicate is huge. The message that you communicate just really, really grabs me. The fact that you're wearing a weighted vest in some of your, is that a rucking vest? There's something that you're wearing that also obviously grabs me. There's one, I have it in my notes here and I have to jump forward to it because there's the three topics you talk about is lifespan, health span, and soul span. And I know you've got your regular email, like I said, talking about that. Now I'm coming back to this purpose piece that you just mentioned there. How important is that sense of purpose to what you're seeing with people with cardiovascular disease? Do you think that there's an emotional and a way we're living your life that is impacting that health piece then, and maybe coming up in a cardiovascular point of view that you see? Do you think that that's part of why people are getting sick? And or, you know, when you talk about that sense of purpose?
I think it's the most important of all three axes. As you alluded to, I define health across the optimization of three domains. Lifespan, how long you live. Health span, your ability to move and think in the world, i.e. the avoidance of dementia. And then soul span is about kind of the meaning and purpose of the time that you have at that high quality. So quite frankly, the first two domains are really in service of the third. The reason that we want to live long and healthy lives with a high functional capacity is that we can spend more time engaging with the world in a way that we find meaningful and purposeful. I think it is the highest priority. It is, as Nietzsche says, he who has a why can bear almost any how. And I think the reason...
Yeah, again,
can bear almost any how. So Nietzsche said this and became, I suppose, very much popularized by Viktor Frankl in his book, The Man's Search. In Man's Search for Meaning, who was a psychiatrist who spent 4 years in Nazi concentration camps. And so we all find ourselves in places in life, but I think it is our future goals, which becomes our why and our story, is the thing that motivates us to do the things that we have to do in the present. I have no interest in living longer for the sake of living longer. I have no interest in being kind of having a higher percentile in muscle mass or muscle strength. I have no interest in, you know, staving off dementia for their intrinsic purposes. The reason I do those things is so that I have more time at a high quality to do what I believe is meaningful and purposeful for me. And that goal is quite individualized for each individual person. So the concepts of lifespan and health span, they are born out of our scientific understanding of the studies that we have best evidence, so we can apply it and we can say, listen, if you hit the 75th percentile or above within these particular metrics, you stand to increase the probability of living longer at a high quality. But in terms of how we go about understanding soul span, in terms of how you're going to spend your time, that is a very individualized outcome for everybody.
Yep.
But there is a formula, I believe, that you can apply to it to help people give the framework to think about how to solve it. And so that is going back to kind of the tenets of philosophy, music, art, literature. It's about understanding who you are and why you're here.
I read a great book called Black Hole Focus. Isaiah Hankel wrote it, and it was all about, you know, it was a period in my life where I was very stressed out and had a few things going on, and it was talking about the sense of purpose, which as a 23 or 4 year old, I was like, purpose, what does that even mean? And this brought me on this rabbit hole of that exact thing. And you said, you know, that effectively you want for your soul span, you want to be as healthy a version of yourself as you can be to get there. How have you determined what meaningful and purpose, what is purpose in your life? Is it this formula that you said of looking at different, you know, arts, cultures, etc.? Or how does one go about determining that? Or how have you realized that you've had to do that?
So first is know thyself. And it's the primary tenet of all philosophy. So you have to know who you are and what you're about. And the first thing you need to realize is that most people do not know who they are and what they're about. They will find that many of their preferences, their likes, their values are extrinsically driven by environmental factors around us. We are highly incentivized creatures. But you have to understand, you know, what your personality is. Your personality is malleable to a degree, but there's set criteria that we have, just even looking at things like the big five ocean criteria in terms of openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeable, neuroticism. So what type of person does that kind of give you the set of personality traits? What are your values? And when we talk about values, we talk about extrinsic and intrinsic motivated. And intrinsics are, what are the things that you would do if just, it didn't matter if you were being paid for them or getting secondary rewards for them. And basically, can you align those personality traits in pursuit of those intrinsic values so that when you do those things, you find meaning in the world? And people often get stuck with this idea of kind of meaning because they will go, well, there's no pre-specified meaning of life. And that may or may not be true. That is kind of the output of what Albert Camus, the French Algerian philosopher, would say, that he's an absurdist in terms of, you can ask the question, but it doesn't matter whether there's an answer, we're never going to find it.
Yeah.
But what can you do to find life meaningful? So it doesn't necessarily imply an answer, but you can engage with the world in such a way that you find the world and the life that you're in meaningful. And if that is starting a successful company and being, you know, wildly successful and making lots of money, that's what you should do as long as it meets those criteria. Yeah. If that's spending time in nature, do that. If that's spending time, you know, being the best parent, whatever that is, you should do that. And understand that there will be chapters in your life.
I'm absolutely loving this conversation, and it's so enlightening. As I say, I won't keep saying it, but to hear an actual Andy, you know, talking about that purpose and all of these things that I believe in and I agree with you. But what I see with my clients who have not gotten to your stage where they need your intervention yet is that the pull to be that, you know, whether it's a mom that wants to be a stay-at-home mom but feels like she should be in a career and should be doing this, that, or a dad who's not earning enough money, wants to be the dad, best dad in the world. Like, to me, those stresses, and I'm dabbing my toe into that world now as I have a little daughter, but I have to leave her for maybe 12 hours a day some days, and that breaks my heart. To do that breaks my heart. Do you think that this is something that is becoming an absolute epidemic in some ways, that people are getting so pulled in so many directions and losing that purpose and losing all that it's just, I don't know where this is going to end or where this is going to go. These values are being pushed on us as what we think we need for life, and then all of a sudden we realize that we're living what we think we should be doing, but what we want is here, and this piece in the middle is causing anxiety and health decline and addictions and all of this sort of stuff. I don't know what the question I'm actually asking here is. I'm kind of trying to absorb how quick you're talking and what you're saying, and just trying to process that to go, is this really the big thing that's making our population and our nation sick?
Yeah, it's our, like, my ultimate aim in life is about discretionary free time. That is the definition of wealth. I know lots of people who have lots of money and are not very wealthy along that domain.
Yeah.
And so what people are looking for is true wealth, is autonomous discretionary free time. Mm-hmm. And we live in a world where we have that ability continually tightened around us. It's more expensive to live in certain ways. It's harder to be able to spend more time with your family. And the reality is Thomas Sowell so famously says, an American philosopher, there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. And so you have to ask, again, go back and you say, listen, for me, I could have continued on my career as an interventional cardiologist and being paid very, very large sums of money. But I realized that to do that for me would have meant compromising my highest values in terms of how I spend my time with my family, in terms of time in nature and do those things. And so I was willing to sacrifice all that prestige, all the time I had invested and the money that goes with it, because I valued those things higher. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I had to go back down the mountain, continue my training and pay a huge price for it. But the price to going in the other direction would have been far higher.
Sure.
And so for me, a lot of it is about shutting out external noise.
Yeah.
It is about the, you know, I'm going to paraphrase, I think it's Charles Bukowski who said it, the American author. He says, who were you before the world told you who you should be?
Yeah, it's a super one.
And so the reality is most people are the world that they should be. And so when you strip away all the external noise, all those cues to tell you who you should be, and you say, listen, okay, fundamentally, who am I, what am I about, and what are my goals and objectives? And then you can prioritize those and say, listen, okay, what do I need to sacrifice? And you will have to sacrifice something.
Yeah.
What do I need to sacrifice to maintain those things as my highest order preference? Mm-hmm. And if they truly are your highest order preference, if they are representations of your internal values, and you really believe that they are your why for doing things, the how becomes so much easier to do. It doesn't make it easy to do it, but you can make decisions in terms of maybe where you live, maybe the type of job that you're doing. There's a lot of people who work in roles and they fundamentally know that they're doing it not because they really like it, but maybe it pays adequate amounts of money for them to work a certain job, but they're paying a price that is substantial. And maybe you have to reevaluate, you know, the type of job that you do. I had to. But I would say arguably that has been the biggest determinant of my happiness and health, was actually giving up a very kind of prestigious job. Mm.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, the change, that discomfort of change. So I've worked for myself for 20 years, and I worked in a job which I really was unhappy in at the start, before I got into this, back into the fitness industry. And it took me hitting like a rock bottom mentally to go, I can't do this. I can't get out of bed to go to work here. And then just changing that. For you to come back down that mountain was huge. was it a mental piece? I think, don't quote me, but one of your social media posts, you spoke about living, eating unhealthy and being around in circles that you didn't enjoy. And did you experience like mental health sort of stuff, or did you just experience an unhappy sensation? How, like, what was the piece that you went, what, like, what was that one moment where you went, I can't do this, this needs to change?
So that was, I was working in that particular institution. I had completely burned out, and I was watching all my colleagues burn out. Loads of my colleagues were committing suicide.
So kind of in the world.
Yeah. And so this was becoming a huge issue. And I didn't know really what was happening, but I could feel that existential sense that this is the wrong thing to be doing. But I had invested 20 years at this point, getting to that point. But for me, I just could not continue in that. And as you had pointed out, you can continue for so long until eventually you reach a threshold where you say, you know, things break. Mm-hmm. And you then say, well, okay, you get to start again. And that has happened to me multiple times throughout my career. You have to have the courage to begin again, and again, have the courage to become who you are. Because if you don't, you're fundamentally lying to yourself.
Yep.
And as one of my favorite quotations is from the HBO series Chernobyl, that says, for every lie that is told, a debt is incurred to the truth, mm-hmm. and eventually that debt will be paid. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't change, you will pay a price, and there will be a debt, and it will be paid. And I was paying that price. And so I realized that the easier path was to turn around and go back down the mountain, because I was in the wrong place.
It's a non-traditional. You may say that was the easier path, and I would agree with that, but it's non-traditional. And what I see is that, you know, that symptom that comes up, that thing, that itch that someone feels, if they don't scratch that, it manifests in another way. And people tend to just keep, there's a great line, what we resist persists. And if you don't deal with that itch, it tends to just keep manifesting itself. And do you think that at the end of that manifestation of symptoms, that people are then coming to your clinic with their cardiovascular that obviously, and external factors, or, you know, their foods, etc., and lack of exercise. Do you think that is a big contributor? You clearly do, but...
Yeah, I mean, we're incentive-based creatures. We live in a world that does not incentivize the best healthy behaviors. Mm-hmm. It, you know, I look at kind of four major levers, just like anyone else interested in health. You're looking about optimization of exercise, nutrition, sleep, and basically stress management. And our modern world does not incentivize that in any way in a positive sense. Mm-hmm. We're incentivized to burn our sleep bridges, to be distracted on social media, mm-hmm. and basically cause ourselves emotional distress. We live in a food environment that prompts us to eat things that we probably shouldn't. And we are so time compressed, and also the way we live our lives does not promote healthy activity on a daily basis, and give us the time and opportunity to engage in the health related activities. And you've destroyed the four major pillars of health. And we wonder why people have such poor health metrics. And so people are struggling with this. This is incredibly difficult. Mm-hmm. This is our world that we actually live in. And because of that, a lot of people's health metrics are poor. And people are very concerned that they may have persisted in that domain so long that they have advanced to disease, and they want to do something about it. People know what they need to do. They often just struggle with ways to actually achieve those goals. And, you know, you had said that you and I are both in the same business, and we are. We're basically, it's about getting to people to hit their goals. I have a particular view about health, insofar as I'm kind of a libertarian view on health. I don't think that my job is to tell people what to do.
Ooh, same.
My job is to help people hit their goals. And so I say this to people, I say, listen, if you want to be kind of extreme athlete and you want to hit all your health goals, I can help you do that. But if you want to be a Hunter S. Thompson type character who's sitting at home, you know, doing lines of cocaine, drinking chartreuse in a hot tub, kind of, you know, writing the great American novel, I say you should do that. Because if that's really what you want to do, we need all colors in the world. And our time here is finite. And, you know, we get the great American novel. And all of us die in the end. Mm-hmm. And if that is really how you want to spend your time,
you're okay with that. I agree with that. I would have found that hard at the start of my career, because I suppose the way I look at it, it's like Instagram filters. I have my filter for how I see the world and how I feel people not should live their lives, but, you know, optimize. Like, why would you not want to be the best version of yourself you can be? Over time, I've started to accept that if someone wants to be that person and that's how they want to live life, that's 100% fine. My difficulty then comes when they come to me in an unhappy, I want to lose weight, I've got this health issue going on, I don't like, you know, how I'm living. So it's, there's a lot of conflicting stuff being thrown at us and being pulled at us as to what success is. And you know, my version of success is when I, well, has changed a bit, but when I can sit on my couch at home, look out the window with a calm mind, with my beautiful wife beside me and their baby beside me, and be content and happy in that moment. Because if I start putting other markers on it, you know, my mind takes over, other little pieces kick in. I feel like we could, obviously philosophy of everything is huge for you. And I feel like I could talk to you about that all day. And maybe that's podcast number two. We'll have to get you back in again. But there's a word that you possibly dislike, that it is, again, tying our world together a little bit. And that's the whole biohacking world that, you know, we've been exposed to on social media. You're not a biohacker by any means, but biohacking, for those of you who are unaware of what biohacking is, in my opinion, it's simple. Starts out with very simple ways that you can externally bring, you know, optimize your health and improve how you function, for whether it's for athletic reasons, whether it's for vanity, or whatever else. Generally, they're health driven things that people are using. What's your thoughts on this whole biohacking world that people are jumping in cold plunges and taking methylene blue and infrared sauning and, you know, injecting themselves online now with this? It used to be that fitness people would lie about being on steroids. Now they're openly injecting themselves on their social media channels, showing you what they're taking. Like, we've got bombarded with this. What's your thoughts on it in a nutshell on this biohacking world that we're living in?
I think most of it is majoring in the minor. I think there are big levers that we can change. We know that, you know, if you get exercise right, and you achieve high levels of aerobic fitness, and also muscle mass, muscle strength, muscle power, that you're getting 8 hours of sleep at night, that you have normal blood pressure, you don't have diabetes, you're insulin sensitive, that you keep your cholesterol levels under control, and you don't smoke and you drink modest amounts of alcohol, you can probably add 10 to 14 years of additional health span. That's not lifespan. Yeah. That is higher quality years. And then additional life years thereafter. So if you look at what I've just spoken about, that is the simple application on a very diligent level around exercise, nutrition, sleep, and stress. Mm-hmm. And that gives you 10 to 14 years of health span.
Yeah.
There is no evidence whatsoever that all the kind of the biohacking tools will give you anywhere near the same magnitude of change. The difficulty comes when someone is choosing to do those things instead of the core things.
Sure.
The problem then becomes is when you're doing all those core things and you've maximized those things, are there additional benefits to doing these add-on activities? I think there possibly are, but we have to be very careful about what your specific goals are. Mm-hmm. So if we take, say, cold plunging, for example, if cold plunging makes you feel better and sets you up for the day and you were able to hit your goals, and you find that, like, on a general basis, that if the days that I don't do cold plunging, I don't perform as well, I don't feel as well,
you
knock yourself out.
Go for it.
Yeah. And then the question is there downsides to these particular things? Because cold plunging in general, for example, it's not going to be harmful. But you also have to look at how you're going to deploy your time and also your capital. So, you know, can you fit a cold plunge into your house? Mm-hmm. What are you going to have to get rid of? How much time are you going to have to spend doing this? I mean, simple things like exercise, for example. If you have to spend a lot of time exercising, that is time that you're not spending doing something else. And so everything comes as a trade-off. So again, going back to Thomas Sowell, there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. Mm-hmm. And so, again, I mean, when you talk about things like methylene blue, the evidence that I would consider a threshold to use it just isn't there. You know, is it to say that, you know, that there isn't potential kind of benefit from it? Maybe there is, but I certainly have not seen evidence that would convince me to use it or certainly recommend it to my patients. Mm-hmm. I'm always open-minded to how we develop new evidence and how we discover new things. But I think the real key has to be is that you have to define your goals. And you will know, I mean, if someone says, listen, I want to be an ultra-endurance racer versus a powerlifter, the training inputs are oceans apart. Mm-hmm. And so it's about clearly defining, what are your goals? Are you hitting kind of the major pillars? And then those minor pillars, what I would say, you know, are they acceptable as a trade-off and kind of upside versus downside?
Yeah.
You know?
I like that. We use the acronym. If a new client comes in, we'll sit down and talk about a plan and goal setting. And what we use to determine, you know, the journey they need to go on is based on DRESS, which is diet, rest and recovery, exercise, stress management. And we used to say supplementation, but we now call it supportive mechanisms. Because so many people are like, oh no, I take my vitamin C, I take my magnesium, I take this, still drink excessive amounts of alcohol, don't eat adequate protein, don't get adequate sleep, live a very stressful life. So all of that, in my view, this biohacking world, it is exactly that. It's supportive. It supplements a healthy lifestyle. And as soon as we think that it replaces all the rest of those things, that's unfortunately where we don't see the payoff. Are there any of these wellness trends that you feel are detrimental, or that there's, I mean, that for example, from a dietary point of view, without you having to delve into it too much, like the carnivore diet, for example, have you an opinion or thoughts on that you'd like to share?
So I think the dietary world has become incredibly overly complicated and polarized. I think that my general rule of thumb is that pretty much most diets are the same. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to, again, be quite precise in terms of what are your goals. Are you trying to add weight, gain, you lose weight, or stay the same? Mm-hmm. And then that sets your calorie target. Mm-hmm. What is your protein target for what you're actually trying to do? Mm-hmm. And then you can fill in the gap with fat and carbohydrates, and also have adequate amounts of fiber, and use the dietary approach that works for you, that makes kind of, it's sustainable, enjoyable, and that doesn't drive a lot of your risk markers through the roof.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if that's the carnivore diet for a period of time for you, that actually makes you feel better, that doesn't drive your risk markers through the roof, that you hit your goals in terms of, say, losing visceral fat and improving insulin sensitivity, and that you don't get utterly constipated from a lack of fiber, you know, like, more power to you, you know, in terms of how you do it. Would I, you know, have I adopted it for myself? No. But again, I think that the nutritional literature in terms of long-term kind of dietary strategies, we just have such a poor data field. Mm-hmm. And so I generally say, you know, hit the core metrics, hit your calorie target, hit your protein target, ideally with real food, eating enough fiber, and that you don't drive your lipid parameters through the roof, and you can fill in the fat and carbohydrate around. As you like.
If you were talking food with someone, would you ever talk about food quality as well in that scenario, in the sense of, and by food quality, because for me, food quality is something that's become very important at different stages in my life. I've had, as a kid, I always had eczema, and it was, you know, everywhere, and it gets bad or worse at different stages based on what I exposed myself to. Bad now because I've changed climate from Portugal to Ireland and my skin didn't like it. But I know that if I eat poor quality foods, and that might mean that, you know, if I'm not eating good quality meats even, that I just don't feel the same. Now, I'm hypersensitive, I've an autoimmune issue, etc. But when you're talking nutrition with people, do you talk about the quality of food, or do you think that the organic clean foods are overhyped?
I think it's very hard to know your selection in terms of whether you are getting truly kind of organic foods without the things that you're concerned about. And I think you have to approximate with, are you eating a real food rather than a food substitute? Yeah. And then again, it's does this dietary approach work for you in terms of how you feel when you eat it? So, you know, we can say, listen, you're hitting your targets in terms of the things that we've talked about. But if you're filling the gap with kind of 100% carbohydrates that are kind of pure sugar, and even though you might be hitting your kind of linear calories and your macro targets, you're going to feel like shit. Mm-hmm. So you have to reflect on kind of like, is this strategy actually going to make you feel okay?
So that sounds like such an obvious observation. Yes, my opinion, like, I see so many people, I'm like, well, how do you, like, you know, they may have gas, bloating, diarrhea, constipation, all of these issues that arise. I'm like, but they don't attribute that to anything that they're eating. And oftentimes they're like, well, I'm, you know, they may have seen it somewhere about this healthy juice or this, you know, type of food or this quick flapjack that you can make yourself. Yet the food, there could be just one little trigger in there that could be causing a little bit of a gut issue. But people just don't connect the food with the how they feel. And that's, I suppose, in some ways, kind of me coming back to what I'm talking about. The food qualities, in my opinion, can drive energy levels. They can cause you to crash. They can cause bloating. They can cause irritations. They can cause all sorts of different little pieces to the puzzle, which when we talk about that DRESS acronym, it's another stressor. The foods, I think, can be a massive stressor. And you know, when I would have done some nutrition courses in the States where they would have spoken about grass-fed meats and all of these great things. At the time, this was 2010, I was like, God, is everything not grass-fed? I thought all meat was grass-fed. Little did I realize, I remember driving up, I think it's the, is it the five up the middle of California?
It's five and 405.
Yeah, and just seeing these fields of cattle that were in, you know, slatted units, and you could see the big cloud over them, and they're all being fed this. So I think that that world, I think we're very fortunate in Ireland that we do have access to actually good quality food. And you know, seasonal stuff that's really healthy and really good for us. In my opinion, it does make a difference to go for quality, but then again, it obviously costs a little bit more as well. Do you feel, as I talk about Ireland versus the States, how do you feel Ireland has evolved as a nation from an actual health point of view, from, you know, back in the 90s to now? Do you think there's obviously been some dramatic changes in things. What's your thoughts? Are we going the right direction?
Oh, definitely. I think we're going the right direction. I think that there's any amount of figures that we can quote in terms of overweight, obesity, you know, diabetes, hypertension, pick your health metric. And they're certainly not where we would like them to be. And many of them potentially are trending in the wrong direction. But in terms of the zeitgeist, in terms of thinking about kind of health as a priority and using the tools that we talked about in terms of focusing on nutrition, thinking about like protein as a macronutrient. I'm sure when you were younger, like the idea of talking about protein was just ludicrous. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it's become part of the general conversation, and that's fantastic. If you look at the general broad adoption increasingly of exercise across both aerobic and resistance training kind of opportunities, it's become kind of so much more acceptable. I'm going to blank on his name, but there is a Kerry trail runner who was quite famous, and he used to train in his regular shoes and jeans and run on the road. And basically he would stop if a car came because he would be embarrassed to be seen to engaging in activity called running. No. And, you know, now it's just become kind of part and parcel of the general culture. I think there's greater focus on optimal sleep in terms of its impact on people. I think there's a greater focus on how your cognitive health actually plays a big role in terms of how you're going to perform during the day. So sure, I know that we can all pick a whole pile of statistics that aren't great and maybe some of them getting worse. But in general, it's becoming much more a part of the general conversation that these parameters are important and have consequence and are worth investing in. So I think Ireland has transformed amazingly.
Yeah, massively. And when I used to coach people initially, the first five or six sessions, I'd be explaining what a squat is and working on their hip and knee mechanics to get them into a squat. You know, and people just thought it was the funniest thing in the world to be squatting. They're like, I'm like a dog going to the loo here. I remember a politician I trained at the time who just, he wouldn't do a squat if there's someone else standing beside him in the gym because he just thought it was the strangest thing ever. Versus now, most clients that come in and assess, I'm like, right, we'll have a look at how you're squatting. Okay, that's good. Let's load it and see where you are in a loaded. I think it's progressed massively. If you were, you know, in a position of power in the country where you could, you know, you obviously do impact a lot of people, but if you could make some changes to things in Ireland around just health across the board, nutrition, exercise, all of the above, could you put it down to one or two little things that you think we could improve on?
I think it's an incredibly hard position to be in managing population health. I would like, I mean, I think it's possible to do. I mean, if you look at the impact on smoking that's happened worldwide and in Ireland, it's been a huge change. And that was a government-led decision that has actually caused significant reductions in morbidity and mortality. I really don't know the answer at a policy level. I've always been clear to say that my role is as an individual clinician working with an individual client and a patient. I'm not a policymaker, but I do think that greater opportunity to be able to engage in physical activity and making it easier in terms of, if you look at like the cycling environment in Dublin, for example, it's much better than it was, but it's still a hairy activity. And so if you look at the infrastructure that exists in other countries, and we'll take the optimal one, obviously being somewhere like Amsterdam or the Netherlands, you encourage these decisions. And so again, we're incentive-based creatures. And so if you can incentivize people to make the healthy decision, rather than trying to have it being forced upon them, it changes things at a national level. I think our food environment makes a big difference. I think people should be allowed have free choice over what they eat, but there's a famous line that says, when all your choices are bad choices, you don't really have a choice. Mm-hmm. So if you walk into, you know, any, you know, filling station or kind of place that you're going to put petrol in your car, and you look at your food options, you effectively have no options. So you have an infinite array of options, but in truth, you actually don't have any options. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always reluctant to impose things on a top-down level, but I'm mindful that if you're making decisions at a population level, you're going to be restricting access and kind of prompting people to do things, as opposed to an individual level is much more of an individual free choice thing. So, as I said, my skills lie more in the individual management.
That's a politically correct, good answer. I understand. I get that 100%. I think the convenience of eating healthy, it's an inconvenience to eat healthy a lot of times. It's just hard to get good quality, you know, food that's not been processed many times, or food that's been, it's easy to get stuff that has a long shelf life, let's put it that way. And I don't know what the solution, or if there's a solution to that, but I do think that we are what we eat, and that, you know, like a bag of Maltesers when you and I were kids was this size, and now it's the big bag that used to be shared amongst the family a number of years ago. That's the kind of the average size. So moving away from the food piece, something that, again, it's kind of connecting back to the emotional side of it. One of the things I want to ask you about was broken heart syndrome. Why do you laugh?
it's one of the more popular
questions.
Topics, but it's funny. It's almost entirely unrelated to, like, it's this, if you look at heart disease as a general umbrella term, it's composed of like potentially thousands of different subconditions. But if you look at the thing that drives the biggest mortality as heart disease being the leading cause of death, it's basically atherosclerosis, so the buildup of plaque in the major vascular territories, predominantly the coronary arteries. And that accounts for like 90% of all the deaths in heart disease. If you look at the amount of deaths that, say, broken heart syndrome causes out of it, it's like 0.00001%. So like it's got all this like huge attention, but like, occupies kind of on a percentile kind of basis. Just this tiny percentage,
but it is a thing. And I just want, like, did you talk about this on your social media that only recently, and you probably gave the exact question. I mean, it's not even a question, but broken heart syndrome is something that, I don't know, maybe I just live in this emotional thing in my head where I think there's so much emotion, and, you know, there's books written, I don't know if you've ever heard of, like, Louise Hay, for example, who speaks about the connection between emotions, her beliefs are that there's a huge connection between a lot of modern day illnesses are connected to, like, resentment, fear, anger. This was her. She's written a whole book on it. It's very interesting, and, you know, probably take you about 15 minutes to read it. But the broken heart syndrome thing, I do think I've seen it in the animal world. You laugh at two dogs that were, you know, lived alongside each other, and one of them passes away and the other one passes away soon after. But you can just see their whole demeanor change, the way they go off their food. That sort of stuff for me, I find very interesting. For you, it's probably like...
No. So I've seen quite a few cases of broken heart syndrome. You see it on a fairly regular basis. And so broken heart syndrome, by definition, is a sudden onset of heart failure. So in a particular pattern where kind of the apex of the heart or the tip of the heart kind of balloons out. Mm-hmm. And it's also, very commonly seen in postmenopausal females after the death of their husband.
Okay.
So it's typically after an emotional kind of stressor. It's called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy originally, which is a Japanese term for an octopus fishing pot, which is basically a tight, narrow neck with a wide kind of bottom. And that's the configuration that the heart takes on after it. It's also been described as a cause of sudden cardiac death in people who suffer sudden traumatic events. So there's been multiple cases of people who have been, say, mugged, for example, but they didn't actually get physically injured, but died suddenly. It's generally considered not to be fatal. It can be very impactful in terms of it can cause heart failure, where people require admission to hospital. It often mimics a heart attack in terms of how people present to the hospital. And it is generally, with kind of appropriate treatment, reversible. But it is very well described in the literature. Probably has obviously existed for a very, very long time, but was only very kind of recently described.
Categorized.
Kind of properly.
Is there a connection with anxiety and heart-related issues? There are connections. Obviously, people who have, like, palpitations and panic attacks and all the rest of it, and I know of a number of friends who've gone to hospital thinking they were having heart attacks, which was a panic attack, a very, you know, bad panic attack, I guess. Do you see connections there a lot, or is that something that's not really coming into your world yet?
No, you see it all the time. And so I actually view this in terms of two categories. So people talk about this as the impact of stress and heart disease. And I think about this through intrinsic impacts and also extrinsic or kind of second order impacts. And what I mean by that is that if someone is acutely stressed, stress hormones, all the kind of the typical ones go up and can cause problems with blood pressure, etc. And so we do know from the best of our ability that acute stressors can cause worsening of cardiovascular risks. In my view, I think that's the lesser of the impacts. I think the bigger impact is the people who are generally stressed. And we have to be clear about our definition of stress. Stress is the maladaptive response to the adversity that we face in life. Mm-hmm. It's not the adversity. So it's all about the response.
Yeah, it's how you deal with it. Yeah,
but it's the downstream consequences on those four pillars that we talked about. So people who would kind of self-identify as being high in stress levels tend to have poor sleep. They tend to not be focused on their nutrition and make poor nutrition choices, and often are not hitting their exercise goals in terms of our classic metrics that we would use. So in my view, it's actually the downstream secondary consequences that cause the bigger problems because they impact those bigger levers. But the problem is that if you don't get stress right, you get improper inputs to exercise, nutrition, and sleep. And so often to fix those three metrics first, you need to focus on the stressor in your life. And
yeah, so plug the bath, you know, the bath, if the plug's not in and you're filling up all that water into it, it's just getting out there. You got to put the plug in first before you can worry about trying to.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, even getting into more kind of specific things, like, I mean, if you look at someone who is, say, highly stressed and they are running kind of higher sympathetic tone, so you can see this in terms of heart rate variability being off, the likelihood of them benefiting from the inputs of their exercise training is limited. So they get very little kind of additional gain from a performance perspective, and they also increase their risk of injury. So this is, I think, something that most people should know is that, you know, if you have someone who's very diligent about hitting their exercise routine in terms of, say, 5 days a week, and then someday they wake up and they're feeling really off and they're sick or they've had a really poor night's sleep, I don't advise that you kind of avoid exercise, but I think you should certainly dial back the intensity because you don't really get much out of it and you increase your risk of injury.
Yeah. Exercise is a stressor. Again, one of the first things I will say to people that the HIIT revolution of, you know, in the last 12 years, 10, 12 years was huge when people thought they needed to smash themselves, lie on the floor, take their selfie at the end of the workout, which was, as someone who worked in the CrossFit world from 2007 right through to 2016, I saw those guys that were doing that then end up with, oh, I've got adrenal fatigue, a word you probably don't like, you know, or have developed more serious health issues as a result of that chronic stress that they were bombarding themselves with because they thought that more was more. But the reality is that more of the right stuff is more. I think the exercise piece has to be driven and managed and scaled. And like, I work with a lot of, as I call it, corporate athletes who are high charging individuals who travel a lot, who have to make big decisions, who have to, you know, look after a lot of people and would have a lot of stress. And oftentimes their workouts involve breath work, stretching, maybe some chin-ups and pull-ups and some bodyweight stuff, and that's it. But one of the biggest things that for me now that I'm glad to hear you using that word that I've helped, started to implement was the use of, and I'm not wearing mine at the moment, but the Whoop for tracking the HRV. What are your thoughts on the wearable devices for HRV? Do you feel it's accurate enough? And not saying that your whole world should be dictated by your wearable device, but you did mention HRV, so I want to ask you briefly about that.
So I think HRV is an incredibly powerful tool, and if you look at some of the world's best performing athletes, they will use it. But I think for those elite athletes, they're measuring HRV typically the way that it really should be measured, and that is with a chest strap first thing in the morning that measures ECG rather than what's called PPG, basically going off your kind of plethysmography on your kind of your wrist in terms of kind of the pulse that goes past, because the millisecond differences that you're putting through a square root function the error can amplify substantially. So you used to get an extraordinarily accurate assessment of what's called your or variability, and therefore
it's your or variability.
So, you know, when you see on the TV shows and you see the beep, beep, it's the distance between those two beeps. That is the or variability.
So the HRV is the time
is. So there's various mathematical functions you can put that what's called the or interval through.
Yeah.
So the or interval is the distance in time, it's the time in milliseconds between those two peaks. So you're measuring a very, very precise moment in time. So you need an ECG tracing rather than going off your pulse.
Sure.
The the variability is how much that changes. So if your heart rate is very high or your sympathetic tone, so you're stressed, is very high, the variability will be low. So it'll be tight. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of really kind of fixed.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have high heart rate variability, that variability kind of, it wanders. Even though your heart rate might be, say, we'll just say 50 beats a minute or 60 mm-hmm. beats a minute, on a millisecond difference basis, it's actually varies quite a lot.
Yeah.
And that implies that you have high parasympathetic tones. Mm-hmm. So you're more kind of rest and yeah. relaxed. So the really accurate way to do it is that you're using a chest-based strap that measures your ECG trace. You do it first thing in the morning as you're lying in bed. You record it for 10 seconds. And then you do that over a period of about 10 days to find out what your baseline is, and then also track how it goes up and down in response to training so you can find your local peaks and troughs. Mm-hmm. So rather than actually referencing a population standard in terms of, well, my HRV is X or kind of, and my friend's HRV is Y, understanding that they may be using different devices and they may be putting through different log functions and mathematical functions. So the device may be kind of speaking about an entirely different number.
Yeah.
You have to ask, where is my HRV in relationship to my range? And what does that say about my degree of training, be it overtraining or ready to accept load?
Yeah. Or my degree of stress that I'm inputting here. There's, you know, lack of sleep, excessive stress. I think it's a great tool to have. And it's fascinating. For me, if I'm speaking with a client about their lifestyle and they'll take a little bit on board, but for whatever reason with the wearable and the Whoop specifically, because the thing I love about Whoop is the more data it collects, the more accurate, in my opinion, it becomes. Did you drink alcohol last night? And you'll see it reflected in both your resting heart rate and your HRV. And, you know, you get your green, amber or red recovery each day. And for people who realize, they're going to see the impact that like a night out has on their recovery and their sleep. That is enough for them to go, oh, wow, this needs to stop. I've literally seen people go, I'm just going to give up booze now for a while as a result of one or two of those readings, which you may feel is a bit extreme.
Well, again, you always have to ask, what is your goal? And there are no solutions, only trade-offs. So what are you willing to trade off just to hit that goal? And so like for me, I drink alcohol, but I drink very little alcohol. Mm. And the reason that I drink very little alcohol compared to having historically drank a lot of alcohol is that it totally destroyed my sleep. Mm-hmm. And I also got horrible hangovers. So for me, it was basically, if I have more than kind of like more than two drinks, my sleep is just goes to pot.
Yeah.
I lose most of my deep sleep. I'll be constantly in light sleep. I'll be constantly waking up and I'll feel like hell in the morning. It's not a hangover. It's that I have a significant sleep debt mm-hmm. as a consequence of the interruption to the architecture of my sleep.
Yeah.
And so for me, on a prioritization basis, the trade-off was not worth it. Yeah.
Do you track on your Apple Watch? You say light sleep and deep sleep, so there must be some way you're tracking it.
No, so I think in terms of I go off that largely on a feel basis. The reason being is that I don't think there's any wrist-worn device that can differentiate REM versus non-REM sleep mm-hmm. or deep sleep versus non-deep sleep. I don't think we have the technology on a wrist basis to do it. There was a device out more than 10 years ago called a Zio device that was a head piece device mm-hmm. that tracked EEG.
Yeah.
Went out of business because no one wanted to buy it.
Yeah, okay.
But that, in my view, was the only non-clinical grade device that actually gave you an accurate representation of deep sleep versus light sleep. So I think sleep tracking devices are very important, but I think they're really important just to say, how many hours did you spend in bed likely asleep?
Yeah.
And then you can, in the morning, say, listen, did I get a good sleep or not good sleep? But I think where people run into big difficulties with sleep tracking devices is that they will look at their device, which I don't believe is particularly accurate in terms of making the distinctions of deep sleep and light sleep. And they'll go, oh, I got a terrible night's sleep. And it will make them feel horrible. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's a particular use to making kind of like, and people will subjectively go, oh my God, I do feel not
good. Yeah, right. No, of course you'd be. And if you start, one of the things I would talk to a lot of clients about is not to look at it first thing in the morning because it can dictate too much. But, you know, use it as a tool. Again, input information for a month before you even take any notice of it. And then after a while, start to allow it maybe help form some degree of direction with your training, and, you know, also just go, well, what is working and what's not working?
Yeah, and a trending basis, I think these devices can be kind of useful. Like we all know that, like if you look at, say, assessing body composition with most scales that you use, the accuracy of those scales are not fantastic. But the directional trend for someone in the same kind of time of day with roughly the same hydration status will be very useful.
Yeah.
And so a lot of these devices, I think, are best used as you said, with enough information to give a benchmark of what the highs and lows for that individual are, and then the directional change over time in terms of a trend, in terms of improvement or disimprovement, rather than a specific number.
I love that. I have a Tanita weighing scales, and it's bioimpedance. It reduces bioimpedance to read body fat. And I nearly bought one of the big fancy machines that you stand on and hold. The reason I didn't is I've got like 14 years of records from clients where, you know, their body fat was at X, and on the Tanita machine, which I would always say, look, this is not, you know, go for DEXA scan if you really want to find out what your actual body fat percentage is. But, you know, it's gone from 32 to 24 on this machine over that period of time. That's fantastic. And in my head, I was like, if we stick them on this other machine, it could tell them their body fat's 44 again. And they're like, so getting your head around that, I mean, it's a marker to use. I think if we try and use one thing alone as our, you know, marker for success, I guess, we can get lost a little bit in the bigger picture. I'm conscious of your time, and I'm conscious of all of these questions I have in front of me. But one that I'm personally interested in is a little bit about cholesterol without going down that full rabbit hole. I have a couple of quick fire questions, maybe even on cholesterol, but and I know the answer to the first one already, but the biggest myth about cholesterol that needs to be debunked, what is it?
Well, so I think there's two big statements that people need to understand about cholesterol. Cholesterol, when we think about that, is the package in cholesterol particle. We're thinking about its role in developing atherosclerosis, or the build of the plaque in the coronary arteries. Atherosclerosis, by definition, is the abnormal retention of a cholesterol particle. Okay?
To break that down, the cholesterol particle isn't the problem. It's how it's retained within the artery.
Correct. So think of like a tennis ball that has a package. That tennis ball is going down your artery in your blood, and then basically, for whatever reasons, it crosses over the artery wall and gets stuck in the artery wall. Now, a lot of the time it's going in and out all the time, and there are kind of endless amounts of these particles doing so. So atherosclerosis is when that particle gets stuck in the artery wall and an inflammatory reaction ensues. And it's that build-up residual amount, that is the plaque in your arteries that people talk about. We kind of use this kind of furring of the arteries, but that's technically kind of not true. It's actually in the artery wall. Mm-hmm. It's not lining kind of like a
so
like
it's restricting the volume of blood that can go through there.
Correct. So it's build-up in the artery wall. The second thing to point out is that, so cholesterol as a particle is absolutely necessary for that process to occur. It does not, however, mean that there are not other factors at play that may be even more consequential to the development of plaque accumulation. But there's a necessary component in there. So that's cholesterol.
Yeah.
So if you look at the near-term kind of risk of building up plaque in your coronary arteries, far and away, the biggest predictor in terms of risk is going to be insulin resistance, diabetes, and metabolic syndrome.
So sugary, so driving that.
So the thing is, though, is people will go, well, it's not actually cholesterol that's causing the problem. It's insulin resistance. And the reality is that if you actually look at someone and you stratify someone by insulin sensitivity, so either insulin sensitive, good, insulin resistant, bad, or low cholesterol levels or high cholesterol levels, in this instance measured by ApoB, which is a very kind of accurate measure of kind of your number of particles. If you take someone who is insulin sensitive, good, and you give them higher cholesterol levels, their risk goes up by about 80%.
Yeah.
So it's quite consequential.
Their risk for heart disease.
For heart disease goes up by about 80%.
Yeah.
But if you add in insulin resistance into that, so now you've got high cholesterol and insulin resistance, it goes up about 11-fold. And so the mistake that people are making is that when they say cholesterol doesn't cause heart disease, what they're often mistaking is they're saying cholesterol, when you look at the risk factor that leads to the development of heart disease, it's not the most predictive in terms of the one that has the greatest weight. Mm-hmm. But by definition, if you had no ApoB particles and you had severe insulin resistance, you could have no atherosclerosis. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this is the issue that people face, is that cholesterol is essential to the buildup of atherosclerosis. But it is not the only factor that matters. So that even if you have kind of very modest elevations in, say, LDL cholesterol, if you're someone who's a smoker, who's got significant hypertension, insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, inactivity, all that good stuff, you know, your risk is off the charts. But if you're someone who's very insulin sensitive, normal blood pressure, don't smoke, for example, but you have very, very high lipid values, and potentially kind of some genetic components to that, your risk is very, very high. So this is the thing that I think is important to make that distinction. is that LDL cholesterol is essential to the development of atherosclerosis, but it is not the only factor that is involved. And if you add in all the insulin resistance features and the metabolic consequences, you're pouring gasoline on the fire. Mm-hmm. And so the challenge is that when we're talking about managing insulin sensitivity and metabolic health, they are largely the domains of exercise, nutrition, sleep, and stress. But when we're talking about managing lipid values, unfortunately, it is far less under our control in terms of our nutritional inputs and our kind of dietary inputs. It's much more of a genetic flora that we have, and we tend to then have to use kind of medications.
Yeah.
But when it comes to using medications, it really comes down to what is your risk, over what time horizon, and how do you feel about the risk reduction that comes with those kind of medications?
For metabolic health, have you a metric that you use, or have you a blood test or a number of different tests that you use to actually assess someone's metabolic health, and what are they?
So you have to look at this on a continuum scale. So if someone has diabetes or pre-diabetes, clearly got a very advanced kind of metabolic health issues. Moving further down the scale, so we're kind of identifying it earlier, do they have any evidence of metabolic syndrome? Metabolic syndrome is having three of any of the following five characteristics. Do you have an enlarged waist circumference, high blood pressure, high triglycerides, low HDL cholesterol, or basically evidence of higher blood sugar levels. Mm-hmm. And if you want to go even further down the line, you can assess someone's fasting insulin levels, match it with their fasting glucose, and work out what's called a HOMA-IR score. So if you look at, say, someone who's got metabolic syndrome, they're going to have almost certainly very high insulin levels. And so you can have very high insulin levels for years before your glucose levels start to go off.
Yeah.
So when you've actually developed, say, prediabetes as a function of your HbA1c, which is a marker of glucose control going up, you've likely had insulin resistance preceding that for 10 years. And so these are the tests that we can use to very precisely define someone's metabolic health.
And what level it's at of degeneration. And the HbA1c, it just for everyone listening as well, then correct me if I get this wrong, but that's not measuring your current blood sugars. That's measuring your blood sugars over a more extended period of time. Is that a basic assessment of it?
It's a six week lagging measure of your average blood glucose.
Blood glucose, yeah. Okay, brilliant. So for someone who does have high cholesterol, statins?
So again, this is like statins. It's like you've talked about the boogeyman when you introduced statins. Statins are one of the options we have for pharmacologically lowering LDL cholesterol. If you look at the other options we have, there are many and varied. We have ezetimibe, bempedoic acid, PCSK9 inhibitors, inclisiran, and we will have kind of gene modification therapies that actually work as well. All that matters is you have to say, where is my level? How far is it away from my target level? And do I need to use a medication to get me between A and B? Mm-hmm. Because some people are, you know, just above their optimal level. Mm-hmm. And they can use nutritional changes and kind of lifestyle changes to get them there. The question then is what is my degree of risk? And we define risk in terms of your risk of an event, in terms of a heart attack over a 10-year time frame, and then also over your lifetime. And then you have to ask, well, there comes a proportional risk reduction with this medication, be it statin or otherwise, and is that benefit worth it for me? Mm-hmm. So if you take, you know, the average kind of 40-year-old male who's got moderately elevated cholesterol, we'll just say an LDL of 4, mm-hmm. his blood pressure isn't perfect, but it's not very high, and he's got no family history of, so he's got a family history of heart disease, but doesn't have diabetes, doesn't smoke, is no medications. Their risk of a heart attack over the next 5 years is probably 0.5%, super low. If you go on a cholesterol-lowering medication, kind of no matter which one, statin or otherwise, you reduce that person's risk of an event by about kind of 20%. But you're talking about kind of 0.2% reduction. And so you can go, well, then statins don't work if that's the case. But I'm not interested in 5-year risk. I'm interested in 50-year risk. And if you actually look at the risk models out to, say, 80 years of age, that person's risk of an event may be something like 50 to 60% and reduced down to, say, 20%. If you can dial in blood pressure, it goes down even lower. And where you see this used is that, so the first person will just say like a 1% reduction in heart attacks with statin therapy. And it's like, yeah, it's true. For primary prevention over a 4-year time horizon in a low risk population, that's true. But I'm not interested in 4 years. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in 40. And if you're making a bet over the time horizon of interest, which is the rest of your life, that bet actually is much more likely to be a successful bet. So if you have a 1% risk reduction, that means you have to treat 100 people to prevent one heart attack over a 4-year time horizon. But if you want to treat people out to age 80 years of age, which is likely to be your lifespan, you probably only have to treat 3.8 people. Mm. And so again, it is, what is your risk over what time horizon? And do you want to take the bet that is the probabilistic risk reduction? And the evidence here is really, really clear in terms of the guidelines. Just because you have a risk factor does not mandate that you have to go on a medication.
Yeah.
But just because you have a moderate or low risk doesn't mean that you can't take the additional risk reduction with it. Mm-hmm. So it comes down to your personal risk tolerance. I have the whole suite of patients in my clinical practice. I have patients with multivessel coronary disease, with calcium scores kind of greater than 1,000, and don't want to go on any medications. I don't think it's a particularly good idea, but that's what they choose to do. And as I said, I'm not going to force medications into their mouth. Yeah. They have to understand what their risk is, what the risk benefits are, and do they want to take that bet? And for them, they don't take it. I have younger individuals who have moderately elevated cholesterol and want to be very aggressive about their cholesterol lowering, and they want to go on a medication to actually take that risk off the table. And they're happy based on the calculus of risk over kind of short, medium, and long term. And they take that bet. And I have everyone in between.
So we spoke about what are you prepared to give in exchange for what you're going to do with your life, et cetera. And with the medications, with statins, I see it. It comes onto my storyline on social media and they talk about the dementia piece. I have a question about cholesterol and hormones, because cholesterol is necessary for pregnenolone, which is necessary for sex hormone production. Correct me if I get any of that wrong. Is there any correlation with elevated, with males, which I've seen fit looking men with low, very low body fat, very strong guys get very high cholesterol readings? So is there an elevated testosterone reading and cholesterol, high cholesterol reading that is something that you're aware of that happens? Or is that just because of maybe these guys are also possibly consuming the wrong foods that's attributing to that? Or is that just all?
So, well, I mean, everyone, when we look at their cholesterol trajectory over time, will kind of through midlife, their cholesterol levels will rise. They will kind of then plateau out in kind of mid to later life and then dip down near the end. Some individuals who, you know, these are being described as kind of lean mass hyperresponders, which is a kind of a general kind of term that's been used, are, you know, fit individuals who are eating kind of, who are kind of like metabolically healthy, who are lean, who are eating more saturated fat in terms of their diets, and they get spectacularly high lipid values. And so you see these people kind of increasingly now. And so they get identified as a primary care doctor as having kind of very significant familial hyperlipidemia, which is a genetic cholesterol disorder. But it's often because of their diet in terms of kind of what they're eating. So again, this goes back to when we talked about diet. It's like, are you doing the things that are sustainable and then don't drive your risk markers through the roof? And we know from kind of longer term studies of using, say, the ketogenic diet, that about 30% of patients will get significant rises in their lipid values. But 30% of patients won't have a huge disturbance, and 30% of patients might even have had a small decrease. So this is where you have to look at your individual responses and your change of lipid values over time. When you look at kind of cholesterol as a necessary ingredient for cellular health and steroid function, etc., as a precursor to this, you have to ask yourself, if you look at the circulating cholesterol in your bloodstream, it represents a tiny fraction of your total body's cholesterol. So that if you were to, say, take your circulating cholesterol, your LDL cholesterol, as you measure in your blood test, and you were to reduce it by 99%, you would make barely a dent on your total body cholesterol, which is your total body cholesterol is the thing that is actually required for maintenance of cellular health and all those essential functions. If you took total body cholesterol to zero, which we cannot do, and there are genetic conditions that actually cause that, it would be instantaneously fatal.
Yeah.
So the thing is there is no pharmacological approach on the table that can lower your cholesterol levels to a point that actually seriously damages your body's ability to be able to maintain cellular function and produce steroid hormones.
This is a topic I find very interesting, because there is a lot of conflicting stuff, the dementia thing, the testosterone thing, et cetera, et cetera. We will run out of time if we go down that road. I have a couple of kind of quick fire questions, but another couple of quickie little pieces I want to stick in here. Top three daily habits for maintaining health. Aside from like obviously working on your sleep and something, like if you have physical, like go for a walk in nature type scenario that you recommend, I might have taken.
But this is the thing, is the basics are the big levers. I call it AICT. It's ass and chair time. It's getting the core factors right and just persisting with them. I really think it's you know, probably one of the key things that people could do is on a, say, quarterly basis, actually sit down and reflect and say, listen, how am I getting on with kind of exercise, nutrition, sleep and stress? And am I hitting my targets for what I want to actually hit? I think this is where, if you introduce practices like gratitude, mindfulness and meditation, which are really crucial to how you engage in that reflective process, that can help you make the decisions for those things. So people look at practices like meditation as some kind of executive stress ball, and it couldn't be any further from the truth. Meditation is a way to explore your own mind and understand kind of who you are, what you're about, and to use those practices on a regular basis. So, you know, if those four levers need to be changed, you need a continual process of updating kind of whether you're hitting them or not.
You practice daily meditation?
I try.
It's hard, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But I do hear people saying I'm too busy to meditate, which I'm like, it's kind of like the person telling me they're too overweight to exercise or too unhealthy to eat healthy. So something that I dropped it for a while and got back into it again. And yeah, every time I start meditating again, I realize why I stopped. I wonder why I stopped, because for me, that little bit of reflective time is so important and it's huge. I love your quarterly check-ins. That's not something that I would do myself, but I think something I could implement. How do you keep yourself on track? Do you have do you have a coach? Do you have people that you work with, or do you just do your own thing?
I have a coach.
You have a coach.
The greatest performers in the world have coaches.
Yeah.
We will happily let ourselves down, but we won't let someone else down.
Yeah.
You need someone who stands outside of yourself to help you define what your goals are and how you're going to get there, to push you when you need to be pushed, to be held back when you need to be held back, to adjust your training regime in terms of what your specific goals are over certain chapters of the year. Are you working more on your aerobic training? And so maybe you need to dial back on some of the resistance stuff so you don't kind of completely, you know, whack your ability to be able to perform. Or are you kind of pulling back on aerobic stuff and pushing up on kind of resistance? Are you trying to hit a specific strength, muscle mass, performance goal? And you need someone to help you guide that. So for me, I do two things. Number one is I have a coach who sets what my training regime is, and it makes it just easier then to hit those goals. And secondly, I put all exercise on the calendar as if it was a meeting that I could not cancel. So when someone asks me, do you have free time at this time? The answer is no.
Yeah.
And I'm very fortunate that I can do that. I've worked very hard in my life to design my life in such a way that I can put exercise on the calendar and make it a commitment that I have to stick to.
I say that it's like brushing teeth in the morning. It's a non-negotiable. It has to be. And I think you can overcomplicate that and feel like you need to do, you know, your yoga, your strength work, your aerobic work, but just have that short window booked in to start, and over time that grows. Conscious of time, a couple of last few questions, which is very interesting to see, as an MD, the amount of energy you put into your social media. Perhaps it doesn't take a lot of energy for you, but what inspired you to start sharing so much of your medical content online?
So when I worked in California and did a lot of research publications, we were publishing in big journals and big scientific publications. And if you looked at the reach of those publications, the amount of effort and time you put into that, you realize that kind of the impact in terms of the readership and the amount of people who read it would be often limited for the amount of effort that you put in. At that time, I also launched a podcast back in 2015 when podcasts weren't even cool, was getting 1 million downloads on podcasts back in 2015. And I realized that if, you know, my goal became speaking directly to patients rather than to other medical professionals, and if I wanted to do that, this was a vehicle that was just completely unparalleled, that I could actually use channels like podcasting, for example, to do so. And so right now, my objective is I want to speak directly to patients. I see too many doctors online see using social media as some form of intellectual brinksmanship. And the reality is that they're using it to say, listen, look how smart I am by how complicated I can make this appear. My objective is to be able to speak directly to patients in a simple, understandable fashion that makes them see things that I feel have utility and use them in their life. And I look at the reach that I can have with that, and using channels like social media, there's just nothing that compares in terms of the reach that you can get.
Wow.
With that reach comes other challenges.
Yeah.
There are things that you can do about that, but you there's just nothing that compares. If you want that reach directly to patients on a global basis, there's nothing that compares.
and you want to reach, you genuinely want to help people. That's the message that I feel like you're genuinely interested in getting that message out there. So it comes across in a very authentic way, which again, you know, I think we're saturated. We're getting drowned in this information overload that's coming at us. We're suffocating for better content. So it's enlightening to hear it. And it's nice to see something about the weighted vest walking through the woods. I'm like, okay, he's practicing what he preaches. And perhaps you see this. I actually work with quite a few of your peers, and they would say the same. How it's like the industry is full of people who are very unhealthy and not practicing what they preach. So it's, and no fault of theirs, they're extremely busy, and it's, you know, that's a whole other conversation as to why the system is that way. So to finish off, I've got 10 quickfire questions that I've not even seen yet. So you can give me a very quick answer, or you can give me I don't know the answer to this if you want, and we won't be offended. What's the most heart-stopping moment you've had in your career?
Oh God, there's been a lot, and technically heart-stopping. I could be here all day, kind of giving you them, one of them, but I do remember it was a young guy in his 30s. And he presented at the weekend, and he presented with just very atypical symptoms, but then suddenly went into cardiac arrest and was having a heart attack. He kept arresting in the emergency departments, and we needed to get him upstairs into what's called a cath lab to basically open up a blocked coronary artery. But every time we would shock him, do chest compressions, he would kind of gain consciousness, and then he would just arrest again. And so we were kind of really stuck. When someone is so unstable, you can't move them when they're that unstable. But we just had to make a run for it. And it was like, you know, as it was straight out of kind of the ER kind of stuff, in the corridor, kind of doing the chest compressions, people arresting in the corridor, doing this stuff. So get him upstairs. He's continuing to arrest on the table. He's in his 30s. We open up the coronary artery. At this stage, he has basically died and kind of like been shocked back to life well over 30 times at this time. You know, I'm covered in sweat. It's all very, very, you know, dramatic and stuff. And we go downstairs, and he's in the coronary care unit, and I'm doing an ultrasound on his heart to see kind of, is there any particular kind of damage? Because to see kind of that the blocked coronary artery had been blocked for long enough. But thankfully, it actually was all very quick. It all happened in the hospital, but he was very quiet. And he asked me, he goes, just tell me straight, doctor. He goes, did I have a heart attack? And I went, you did. And he goes, was it serious? Like,
pretty serious.
Pretty serious.
I love it. That's brilliant. If you were to pick one, would you, and I know that you've put it up on your Instagram as well, but if you were to pick one that you could only do for the rest of your life, would it be strength training or aerobic training?
It'd be aerobic training.
Interesting. Okay. Grilling versus frying your food.
Couldn't care less.
Really? Does it make a difference?
Well, I go on taste.
Okay, fair enough. That's fine. Morning workout or evening workout?
Oh, morning.
Heart healthy food that secretly tastes terrible, but you still recommend?
I don't think there are any heart healthy foods or unheart healthy foods. I think there's your body, how they process it, and its macronutrients.
That's a very Paddy Barrett answer. Well done. If you could prescribe one thing that's not medicine for heart health, what would it be?
Meditation.
Brilliant. Dr. Paddy Barrett, I'm looking at your clock going, this man needs to be somewhere else now, and I've kept him for much longer than anticipated. I absolutely love that. Thank you so much for your brain, your time, and your energy. I've loads more questions there that I didn't even get to, but I feel like there's a huge amount to digest, pardon the pun. Thank you very much. If for people who want to learn more, you have a newsletter, that it's a weekly newsletter, isn't that correct? People can just sign up via the link in your Instagram, and your Instagram handle is just Dr. Paddy Barrett.
Just put Dr. Paddy Barrett
into the Google box and we'll find you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much.